is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Shalom, Rabbi Brent.
Shalom, John. Lovely to be here with you again.
And today, Rabbi Brent is going to do the next in his series of Jewish philosophers. And this time we've come to Baruch Spinoza. Mm. So, Rabbi, shoot. I mean, commence.
Spinoza is a really fascinating character and a really controversial character, actually, in traditional Jewish circles. He is considered to be really one of the three foremost rationalistic philosophers, and not even Jewish philosopher, any philosopher of the 17th century, along with Rousseau and with Leibniz. He was born to a family of Portuguese conversos, families who had been forced to convert following the Spanish expulsion and Inquisition in 1492, and then later in the 1530s in Portugal, there were similar edicts issued. And at a certain point, the kingdoms of the Netherlands, the Edict of Utrecht was issued, inviting families who had been persecuted in Iberia to come and take up residence in the Netherlands. And Spinoza's family was one of those. So he grew up in the household of a Portuguese merchant, and his uncle had come along as well, and had a traditional Jewish upbringing. As part of Congregation Talmud Torah, the Orthodox congregation of the Netherlands. He was considered a promising student at a young age, but as it happened, he started to, see contradictions and problems as he studied, looking at the comparison between Scripture and how the structure of Jewish life was in that day and still continues to be in certain ways. This all unfortunately led to the fact that he was among the last Jews that were sanctioned, put under harem, excommunication, at the age of 23.
Explain about that.
Well, this was the way that Jewish communities used to make sure that that their amcha stayed in line, and if there were individuals whom did not abide by the ethical and religious rules of the community, the leadership of the community actually could issue an edict of harem, an edict of excommunication, in order to say that no Jew should have contact with this person, no Jew may engage in business with this person, this person's not to be allowed to enter into the grounds of the synagogue or any of the communal buildings. But more than that, Spinoza's edict was particularly harsh. You know, if you go and read copies, and it has been translated, the reasons for the excommunication have to do with heretical teachings and not action, so to say.
And he was so young.
He was 23 years old, and you know, you look at the guys being, you know, cursed. May God bring curses upon him. May his name be wiped out and not remembered. Of course, we all remember Spinoza's name very well.
And better than those that excommunicated.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are many who have called for the reversal of this edict of harem. Foremost among them, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, said that it was really time that Spinoza's legacy was cleaned, and he was this idea of harem that he should have been excommunicated was lifted.
So they never withdrew it in his lifetime.
They never withdrew it in his lifetime. And there's different theories about why the community took this tract. I mean, one of them is that certainly Spinoza was saying controversial things, such as questioning the Mosaic authorship of the Bible, questioning that the Bible was written by Moses, who was dictated by God in Mount Sinai and handed through generations in the form more or less as it is today. He also denied the providential aspect of God, that God intervenes in worldly affairs, so to say, in any way other than in accordance with the laws of nature, that Spinoza's philosophy and worldview has a lot to do with God set up the laws of physics, the laws of nature in our world, and the world functions relatively orderly according to these laws. We should expect that God's presence in the world is also according to these laws, which was problematic for the Orthodox community. But more than that, following these terrible incidents of the expulsions danger that members of the Jewish community, the Jews, were put in Spain and Portugal in the 15th and 16th centuries, there was a real concern that someone who did not stay in line and someone who did not practice and observe Judaism in a way that the community was permitted to do so could potentially bring the ire of the secular governments that they lived within.
I should think it would be just the other way around.
It was a time of deep concern and paranoia in the Jewish community, and not necessarily paranoia because there were some pretty strong anti-Semitic forces working against Jewish communities, and these continue to be present in our own day. They were especially apparent last century, sadly, in their I'd say most horrendous form in the Holocaust.
So how did he cope with this? I mean, from the age of 23.
Yeah, his reaction that's reported, which I have learned, is that he was really fine with the cherem, with the edict of expulsion. He said that it was easier for it not to come from him, and it did not force him to do anything that he didn't want to do anyway.
So it set him free, more or less.
Right, right. And he did end up changing his name. He adopted the name Benedictus de Espinoza, a Latinized version, more or less, of his name. And he taught in a Christian seminary studied with a very well-known ex-Jesuit whose name was Van den Enden, later is considered to, I guess, have some similarities to deist thinkers and things like that. Spinoza found more or less a way to live his life outside of the Jewish community, and in that regard can be considered probably as the first truly secular Jew, a Jew living in a non-Jewish world.
But still adhering to the basic...
He wasn't a fan of the ceremonial aspects of Judaism. Mm. Not so much. He never married. He never had any sort of romantic interests, as far as we can say from evidence. He lived kind of a quiet life with his research, and he was offered a number of very prestigious teaching positions around Europe. And each one of these he seemed to turn down and just prefer his own quiet life.
Not quite a hermit, was he was writing?
He did have friends, certainly, and people came to visit, and he was writing. There are many who really respect and loud Spinoza for living a life that was really in concert and in harmony with his philosophy. He stood up when there was a ruler in the Netherlands, De Witt, who was overtaken by a mob and killed, and decried the thing as an awful, barbaric act, literally had to be restrained. There was some concern that he was going to get up and draw the mob's attention to himself and potentially be killed. So
he took part in everyday life then in the Netherlands.
Mm. Yeah.
And was his writing still reflective of his Judaism, or...
His writing.
I don't mean the religious.
Well, if we think about Spinoza and what his writing represents, first of all, his major theological work called the Tractatus Religioso Politico, Theological Politico, excuse me, was written in 1670, and it reflected a lot of these earlier allegations that were said about things he was teaching, and really took further actually some previous observances by none other than Abraham Ibn Ezra, an earlier philosopher of the 12th century, who noticed some incongruencies in the biblical text but never fully explicated what they were. Ibn Ezra is secretive on these things says, you know, when he notices in chapter 12 of Genesis, for example, that there's the statement at that time the Canaanites were in the land, and says, well, at that time the Canaanites were in the land. What does that mean, the Canaanites were in the land? It seemed to us as literary critics that it means that someone's writing this at a time when Canaanites are not in the land. So how could this have, been written with the post-knowledge that it doesn't work out logically? And Ibn Ezra's response was, he wrote two words. He wrote, Hachamim Yavin, the wise ones will know. Very mysterious. Didn't say anything more than that. And Spinoza dives right into this sort of comment, another one that appears in the beginning of Deuteronomy, and says, look at these things. These things tell us that these accounts, this scripture, was written at a time other than what it's stating. There's something hidden here. There's something concealed. And in a way, that work, the Tractatus, gave birth to biblical criticism in the modern world as we know it, where there's quite a bit of research into who wrote the Bible, what its content is, and how it was put together as a canon, and what was brought in and what was excluded. Philosophically, he authored a book called The Ethics, a very, very challenging work that actually was only published posthumously. He died at the age of 45, probably from tuberculosis. We're not exactly sure, but some sort of lung infection. So he died very young. And when he died, it was found this work.
So he only had 20-something years.
Yeah, he was excommunicated at 23, 7 years before he died. He wrote the Tractatus. He's written other essays and works.
What language did he write it in?
Primarily Latin, which was a language he learned as an adult. He also.
So if he went to a Jesuit or was learning with them, they were using Latin compared to the.
His mother tongue was Portuguese.
Yeah.
He probably knew Dutch from living in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
He studied Hebrew when he was at Cheder.
Yeah.
And he would have learned Latin as an adult, and among other languages. He probably knew French as well. This man was pretty intelligent and pretty sharp and understood languages and found it best. He actually authored the Tractatus anonymously, and only later did it come out that he actually wrote this book. But he probably wrote it in Latin somewhat as well, because he was going to be saying some things that would be considered heretical for the time.
So he wrote on the Old Testament.
He wrote on the Old Testament, and he did write on the New Testament as well. The Old Testament, as we refer to in Jewish circles, is just the Hebrew Bible, and it's slightly different in configuration than the Old Testament as it's put together for Christian practitioners of the Christian faith. The New Testament, the issues that Spinoza identified most clearly were that the works of the New Testament, which are primarily in Greek, we don't have, for many of them, we know that Greek is not the original language that they were written in, and yet we don't have copies of them written in the original language, which creates all kinds of questions about, if these works were translated, are they conveying what their author intended in them with fidelity? In terms of his philosophical works, I'd started to talk about the ethics that was written, and Spinoza authored this book with a mind towards Euclid's geometry, and approached in a way such that when he created the first chapters of this book, he would define all of his terms. What is God? What is an attribute? What are the
in mathematical terms?
Exactly. And then he'd use them later, and he constructed it very much like the premises of a mathematical argument. And once he was approached and asked, how are you confident that your philosophy is correct? And he said, I'm confident that my philosophy is correct, just as you should be confident and know with absolute truth that the sum of the angles of a triangle are two right angles. Nevertheless, there are certainly criticisms and questions that arose about his ethics, and Leibniz, one of his contemporaries, one of the three people I mentioned as being the three great rationalist philosophers of the 17th century, is among those that was heavily critical of his work.
So where did he study then that he, had this razor-sharp mind that wanted logic?
Well, he claims to be an autodidact of sorts, a self-taught man.
Right.
Certainly, he did study Torah and Talmud and rabbinic text in Cheder, although he never made it into their advanced classes as far as we know. And then he spent a fair bit of time with this ex-Jesuit, Van den Eeden.
Did he find him a kindred spirit?
Well, I mean, Van den Eeden was also someone who was free thinking, and there were heterodox controversies that emerged out of his own writings, so that his books were actually banned by the church. So kindred in that they both took ire from established religion, for sure.
They must have been glad to find each other, but I should imagine at that time it was quite dangerous to voice contra opinions.
Sure. I mean, this was this was on the cusp of the transition from the medieval world into the modern world. It's the same time that you're starting to see a lot of the political theories, written that would inspire the American Revolution and later the French Revolution. This is a very dynamic time when it comes to philosophy and the way of the world. In terms of Spinoza's lasting influence, biblical criticism, the entire field of looking at the Bible critically and analyzing it as one would a work of ancient literature, is something that's accepted in most religious circles, except for those that are fundamentalist
literal translation.
Well, literal translation, believing that the Bible is authentic and it shouldn't be questioned. Mainstream religions of today, Christianity as well as my own Judaism, accept that biblical criticism has validity, and it's part of our seminary education, well incorporated into it. For biblical studies, it's part of both the Masorti, the conservative, and the reform or progressive training that happens around the world, and even Orthodox Judaism uses textual criticism when it comes to looking at rabbinic texts.
Well, if that's through the years, commentaries have been written by various thinkers and rabbis and so on. Were they all non-critical? Were they all accepting or just looking at different interpretations, or were they part critical or questioning rather than critical?
Well, the manner which biblical criticism approaches textual study is fundamentally different than what rabbinic inquiry does to texts. If we look at what rabbinic works of Midrash, Tanhuma, all these important works that contribute to our understanding and interpretation of biblical texts and contain many glosses into areas of the Bible that don't fully spell out what's going on. So, for example, there's the famous story of the smashing of the idols by Abraham and his father's idol workshop. And that whole story is exclusively found within Midrash. There's no place in the Bible that it exists. So rabbinic commentaries look to the Bible in a way that they want to explain it and its content so that it can give relevance and meaning to either the lives of its contemporaries or an understanding of what the meaning of the revelation was. Biblical criticism does things quite differently. It takes a scientific lens and looks for sort of chiasms in the texts and repetitions and the use of different language and terminology to determine where are there different authors that appear in the text. Is this a continuous text or has it been redacted? To what extent is it edited? To what extent has it been harmonized with each other? And narratively, is it in sequence? These kinds of questions can yield answers that are surprising. And today, it's commonly understood by mainstream biblical criticism that the Bible was authored over many centuries, some scholars believing it to not have started until very late, actually, but that these books were redacted and codified and pulled together over time and eventually put into a codex so that the books that we have today, which traditional religion will tell us are divine revelation from God and not a word or a letter has changed since then, it's simply not true. And in that sense, we have discovered with archaeology, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls today. And if we look at comparing copies of, for example, the Book of Isaiah from the Dead Sea Scrolls with the Book of Isaiah we have today, there are some pretty important differences in words, in the way things are spelled, in sections that have been omitted or added since that text back then, which tells us there's different versions of the Bible, which tells us that it's not quite as simple as the medieval mind would have wanted to know. And the modern mind is much more aware of these discrepancies and congruencies and contradictions that exist therein. And Spinoza is really the person we have to thank for first starting us to look towards that insight.
So I think I often wondered, because today we know so much more about the world than they did then, so it's not surprising but that people were still inquiring at that time. Mm. So he lived a lonely life, but all in his head.
I don't know that he would think or say that he was lonely. I mean, if I have to imagine Spinoza, I'd say that he was driven by a particular vision and a particular understanding, and that he was fulfilled to the extent that he was able to do his research and able to find people of like conscience.
But he was trying to prod, if you like,
there's quite a bit of prodding there, and there is certainly some antagonization, yes.
Yeah. And he doesn't have as many followers as, say, Maimonides does to this day.
We talked about Maimonides also had his controversies, but certainly Spinoza is someone who's still considered outside the fold, certainly of traditional Judaism, and some of the conclusions he reached in his philosophy are quite problematic, but we haven't got into that so much in this talk here.
The question is, do you want to go into that at some future point?
We can, but we may have to save it till next time.
Okay. What do you think his influence is today? You know, are there study circles like there are on Maimonides? Are there, you know, is he discussed, or is it just part of say, rabbinical learning to touch, or for those people who are doing philosophy?
Well, no, I think its influence is much greater in the philosophic world than it is in the Jewish world. Hume, who would live after him, would say that there's two types of philosophers. There's philosophers who are Spinozian, and there's philosophers who are not philosophers really at all. The mind for inquiry and the way that he methodically looked at this really has semblances of someone like Wittgenstein, who would come much later and look with a critical eye towards analytic philosophy. And
so he influenced philosophers of the future.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
And I just wondered if also he is part of what we look at as a Jewish philosopher because of what he did there, but if he was also teaching amongst Christians and was influenced by the Jesuits, is he also read and revered in the non-Jewish community as a philosopher?
I think that he probably finds his best audience in proper philosophy, which is not religious, mm-hmm. but inquiry. His philosophy is controversial in a lot of ways to people who want to hold traditional religious theologies. He really believes, as we talked before, that God functions according to these rules which have been established, these rules of nature and of physics, and believes that God is the essence for the substance of the universe. He's natura naturis. He's found within nature. So to that extent, one of the conclusions that Spinoza draws is all of the ethical doctrines of Scripture are things that can be arrived at rationally, just through pure rational inquiry, and revelation is not required at all. To the extent that, you know, this is so extreme, Spinoza says things like the mind of the biblical Israelites was so primitive that it needed revelation, and it needed the idea that there was divine reward and punishment based on actions, and it needed these elaborate stories and ideas in order to be able to keep order, to keep peace, to keep harmony in the biblical world. That it's quite condescending, actually, when you think about it, that these people who lived in the Bible had not acquired the tools of rational thought, and someone who did have those tools of rational thought, well, religion in an organized and symbolic way was really of no use to them.
So it really was that it was needed by the people at that time in order to live and not tear each other to pieces. And
Spinoza's perspective is that religion was a means of keeping order and control in society. He wouldn't go as far as Marx would later to say that religion is the opium of the masses, but certainly Marx, in his own right, was heavily influenced by Spinoza. If we're talking about people who are influenced, so he did have a extremely important impact on modern philosophy and the modern world, and challenged many of our notions about religion, some more successfully than others, but in any case, those that he did challenge successfully, he's been seen vindicated in many circumstances. And so I think that really today, if we're going to be serious and thoughtful in the way that we approach our own religious lives, we can't afford to ignore Spinoza.
Well, thank you, Rabbi, very much, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday when the Rabbi will be telling us about Purim.